Good afternoon and welcome to Lunch with Leaders. I'm Cindy Morgan, the Vice President of Learning and Organizational Development. I'm really glad that you're here this afternoon. So I hope you can sit back, turn off your MS Teams, turn off your Outlook, take a nice deep breath and get into the learning spirit with us. So for those of you who are new, welcome to Lunch with Leaders. For those returning, welcome back. Lunch with Leaders is an opportunity for all of us across Penn Medicine and leadership roles to come together in community and to learn from our guests, as well as learn from each other on the chat. I just want to remind you that all of our back episodes can be found on the Lead Strong webpage. So just got a great email last week from Lester Lato in the clinical trials unit of the Cancer Center, and he had just watched Catherine Morrison, and he had a session on having difficult conversations now. So what I love is when people are watching the back shows and continuing to get in touch with us and say how much they mean to them. So spread the word. There's really good stuff out there if you haven't gone back to watch some of the shows, maybe shows that you missed. So let's talk about last week's show and what came in the mailbag last week. Last week's show, big hit. Neil Ravitz, the COO of Orthopedics and the CAO of the Musculoskeletal Service Line, was a guest with Dr. Andrea Wieland, who is the Associate Athletic Director of Penn Athletics. And so people were really surprised at Neil's service in Iraq, as well as learning more about his prowess on the gridiron at West Point. People thought the show was positive and inspiring, and I couldn't agree more. Many thought that thinking about teams and sports was a really good parallel or a good construct to what we're doing to build our teams here at Penn Medicine, which is good because that was what we were hoping for. So I'm kind of glad that worked out okay. If you missed it, again, Lead Strong page, it's a good one. So we got two commercials today, as well as the event code for your CMA CE credits. Youngin', happy summer. Summer Cindy is here on Lunch with Leaders. Summer Youngin' is here. Let's hear what our commercials are today.
Great to see you, Cindy, and great to have you here. Thank you for joining us today. The book club with Kevin and Adam Grant will now be next Thursday, July 8th, same time, 7:30 to 8:30. It's a busy time of the year, so hopefully this will give you an extra week to read the book. If you already registered, there's nothing you need to do. The invite will update automatically. The good news is that the deadline for ordering the book has ended, but you can still register and join in. And thanks, Jen, for putting the registration link to chat. And it's vacation time, so if you can't make it, not to worry, because it'll be recorded and posted on the book club website. Now, next, a quick update on the 30-Minute Coach. It's a virtual session where we provide you with some key tools and practical tips on various leadership and talent topics. We always have Q&A session at the end, so please come with your questions. The next session in July will be on developing a growth plan. So it'll be all about how to develop a growth mindset and setting yourself and your team up for success. There are sessions for individual contributors as well as managers. So spread the word. Again, if you can't attend, it'll be recorded and posted on the website as well. And then lastly, to get your CME CE credit, use the text-in feature. Today's event code is 72828. Text that to 215-398-6728. It's open right now and will be for the next 24 hours. The event handout is on the Lead Strong website. For questions, reach out directly to the CME office. And now back to you, Cindy.
Youngin, thanks for all your work. Wanted to do just a programming shift. Typically, Gretchen Kolb, or affectionately known as G by me, is on vacation. So Jen Rader, J-Rad, is manning the chat. Thanks for helping out today, J-Rad. All right. We all have Adam Grant fever across Penn Medicine. I was really setting up this show so Adam would be the warm-up act for our great guest today, and we could build off this concept of thinking again or rethinking. Someone in the chat just said that they saw Adam Grant on a podcast, or they heard Adam Grant on a podcast last night with LMM in the Heights, by the way, if you haven't seen it. Fabulous. It's like restored my energy. Great musical. But we're really hanging with some good company. I agree with you in that chat. So How can we look at something that we've looked at through the same eyes a thousand times and see something different? That's what today's topic is going to be. How do we see new possibilities? How do we solve for the equation in a different way and still get a really good result? How do we continue to evolve and put our own unique brand of magic into everything that we're doing? I know I'm always thinking about this, and I have a gut feeling that I'm not alone on that. So today, that's going to be our focus. How do we train our brains to become better, more creative problem solvers? And our guests are world-class creative problem solvers, and more on that in a minute. So these are objectives of what we're hoping to do today. We're going to talk a little bit about what makes good problem solvers and how do we have a culture on our teams and in our organizations around creative problem solving, having a growth mindset, and taking some comfortable risks to get a different result. We love hearing from you. I'm sure you have as many questions for our guests as I do, although I do have a lot of questions always because my brain doesn't really shut off in terms of curiosity. But I want to have your questions in the chat as well. I'll try to pull as many as I can over to our guests. Let me check in with you. Pull out your phones, though. Let's do a quick poll. You know what to do using your cell phone. Please text Penn Medicine 918 to 22333. Then you'll be in the survey. If you have a challenge, JRED will help you out. What emotions are you feeling today? And of course, I mean, besides hot, because of course, everyone's hot. It's just the hot time, and you're hot. So, what feelings are you having today? All right, while we wait for your replies, I would love to introduce our guest today. Roy Rosen has his MBA, and he's our Chief Innovation Officer, and he works in the Center for Healthcare Innovation. And we have Dr. Sindhu Srinivas. She has a lot of titles. Stick with me on this one. First of all, she is the physician lead for the Women's Health Service Line. Second, she's the Director in Obstetrical Services at And third, she's the HUP Vice Chair for Quality and Safety, all within the Department of OBGYN. Roy, Sindhu, we're so lucky to have you here. So thanks so much for joining me. You can join me on camera at this point.
You stumped me on the poll. I was going to say hot, and then you said I can't say hot.
Yeah, I figured I just would, of course, you're hot. Like, it's just a given. Every participant here today is hot. So I thought I'd challenge us all. Hopefully, we're going to get the cool down, although it may come with a little bit of rain. All right, we're seeing some good stuff here. Overwhelmed, I get that. Energized, smiley face, motivated, relaxed, hopeful.
I'm feeling like I need to get more titles so I can keep up with Cindy.
Listen, she's pretty cool, isn't she? Busy, 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 busy. I get that. Do these words surprise you, Sindhu?
No, they don't surprise me. I in the beginning before the I was expecting some overwhelmed in there when that came up, but now it's being trumped by I love it. Hopeful, excited.
Yeah, good. Headachy.
Good stuff, yeah.
Headachy. Okay. All right, listen, okay is okay. Melancholy, I'm sorry. Hang in there. All right, Casey, thank you. And thanks to everyone for sharing how you feel. Shannon, I'm excited about the upcoming weekend as well. Thank you for sharing that. So, Roy, let me start with you. For those of you who don't know Roy's background, it's super impressive. Before he came to Penn, he was the VP of Innovation at Intuit, and he helped them build products like TurboTax and Quicken and QuickBooks. And through his leadership, Intuit adapted a culture, and it was all around working with the front lines to have new product innovation. And boy, did they see a lot of results. After 5 years of Roy's leadership and working on their cultural change and their approach to growth, they just saw staggering results on shareholder returns. At that time, it was 3 times that of Google's and 33 times the S&P's. Roy also has a really amazing academic pedigree, undergrad at Harvard, MBA from Stanford. It's totally impressive. But here's, I think, what's most impressive, or my own factoid about Roy. Roy, I never told you this, but every time I'm with you in your presence, meeting with you, hanging out with you, and Dr. Ash from the Innovation Center, I always learn something new. And if you've ever worked with Roy or even David, I think you probably could, like me, attest to the fact that both of them just ask the best questions. And I think of questions as a form of intervention that in and of themselves can just make you pause and think differently. So Roy, I'm so glad you're here. So level with us all. Nature, nurture, did you always ask great questions as a kid? Did you solve problems creatively from the time you were out of the womb, or how'd you get good at this?
I actually think anyone can do this. Nature, nurture, I think they both work. I was naturally curious. I always wondered about how everything worked, you know, and I think that helps, right? You know, you talked about curiosity, actually, Cindy, in the opening. And I think that asking questions and saying, does it have to be that way? I'm a little bit of someone who challenges the, you know, norms. That maybe that's part of my DNA. But it is something that I came out with a little bit naturally, but honestly was trained. You know, I worked back in Silicon Valley with these incredible people. And I don't think I said a whole heck of a lot, probably my whole first year, because I was sort of in awe of some of these brilliant engineers and designers and others that I was around. And I just saw them continually changing the problem that I thought we were solving. I mean, it was kind of confusing for a while. Like, I thought we were doing this, you know, now you're doing this. And so it took me a while to kind of figure out some of these, you know, techniques. So there's a little bit of a nurture, but I think anyone can do it.
Thanks. Dr. Srinivas Sindhu, I'm thrilled you're here today as well. And you and Roy have been partners in the past, so I can't wait to see the dynamic between the two of you. Let me just say in the audience, if you've not met Sindhu, she's the embodiment of Adam Grant's suggestion of think like a scientist. Sindhu, she problem solves in her sleep. I'm pretty convinced of it. Her research benefits from her unrelenting pursuit of excellence, especially through creative problem solving. She's always looking for innovation in terms of healthcare delivery strategies to then in turn improve maternal outcomes and reduce disparities, as well as Sindhu studies the impact of practice changes on quality outcomes. So her whole role has been defined by creative problem solving. Sindhu, I'm so glad you're here. How did you know you were a creative problem solver, and how have you continued to improve in this area?
Thanks for having me, Cindy. I'm really excited to be here. And I actually couldn't agree with you more that Roy does ask the best questions. And I actually think that is one of the most incredible ways to get at creative solutions. And we'll get to that maybe a little bit later. But I agree with Roy. I think nature, nurture, I think it's a little bit of both. I think my inherent sort of being is one that doesn't like no for an answer. So when you tell me that something can't be done, I sort of don't believe it and feel like maybe it can't be done the way we think we're supposed to do it, but maybe it can be done a different way. And so I think some of that is learned and you have to be deliberate about it, but I think it's, you know, I think there's a combo nature nurture there.
Great. I'd love to ask you in the audience, when you think about good problem solvers, creative problem solvers, people who ask good questions like Sindhu and Roy both do, maybe you're one yourself. What do you think the characteristics of good problem solvers are? I'd love to hear that in the chat. While we wait for you, Roy, let me turn it over to you. Often, I know even with myself, I can get stuck in conventional thinking. And I think of myself as pretty creative, but sometimes I'm like not even solving the right problem. Kind of like you talked about when you were out in Silicon Valley. What tips or models have influenced how you've approached problem solving since you've gotten better over time?
Sure. You know, and this may be a good place to pull up the slides, actually, because, you know, I think you'd asked me to put a couple quick thoughts down. So I think there's one thing before I even get to the slides that's more important than anything else, which we talk about here at the center all the time, which is get deeply embedded. You've got to, like, get immersed. What people think is going on, what people say about what's going on is often not actually what's really going on. So going to see it for yourself and experience it for yourself is probably the best way to understand what's really happening in a situation, what's going on with the problem. Then there's from a paradigm or rules perspective, there are three things. If you had said I could come up with 10, I would have talked for 2 hours, but you said three. So I'll give you three, and I'll start with the one that people who know me have heard us talk about the most. But, and that first thing And I don't know if the slides are up. I can't see them, but maybe. But
we had a little bit of a slide challenge, and it was like a strobe light. So yeah, we didn't want to make anyone freak out because we didn't have a warning label. Yeah. So we're having some problems.
Cool. Yeah, that's fine. We don't need the slides. You know, so the three things I would call out, first of all, it would be this transition from what we call the five whys to the five so whats. And people, I think a lot of folks at Penn have heard us tell the story about Hertz, and it's a well-known story, but I love it for a lot of good reasons, right? You know, if you go and get embedded and you go and observe what's going on and you see, oh my gosh, look at this, wait, look at this line. You're in this line for like hours and hours. That's horrible. Normally what happens is people define a problem in a very narrow way. It's usually constrictive. It's prescriptive. It's like, oh my God, we got to make the line go faster, right? The problem is the line's too slow, therefore we've got to make it go faster. And if you do the normal root cause analysis, which is a great tool, and say, why is the line so slow? You'll get cool stuff. Staffing model's wrong, paperwork takes too long to fill out, and you'll fix it. And that's value added. The other way, instead of five whys down, is up. So what? What would be good about a faster line? These things that feel like a strange question, right? And so the five so what's about, what would be good about a faster line? Redefine it, takes off the guardrails, takes off the handcuffs, and all of a sudden you say, okay, well, that's a silly question. If, you know, so what? Like, I get to my car faster. Ah, okay. Now I have this problem definition, like from the time from when the plane lands to when I'm on my way, that allows me to do such more creative things, right? So as you guys all know, the solution here is Hertz Gold. There is no line. You're not working on making the line go faster. They got rid of the line altogether, right? Because it was minimizing the time to be in your car on your way. So that way of thinking, I think, is incredibly important. And what I love about it is usually that's where the story ends, right? Okay, you know, no line. But guess what? Once you realize that it's about how quickly you're on your way, you can do better than Hertz Gold, right? You know, it's a $90 billion industry, and Elon Musk sees it and says, I'm going to send a car, you know, to pick you up at baggage claim, so you don't even have to go to the car rental place. But you can keep getting better and better and better and more creative once you have the right, you know, settings. So that's the first one. You know, the second method that I think is so incredibly important, and this is good news for all humans because all humans are good at this, is the use of analogy, right? You know, so if you go to the next slide, like, let's say you're a nurse and you're trying to think about how to get something to fastened on a patient's clothing, on a hospital gown. You know, and you're going out in the woods and you come back and you find all these burrs, these cockle burrs are all stuck to your clothing. Well, guess what? You know, this is what happened to, you know, the George de Mestel, I think his name was, is a Swiss engineer in the mid 1940s. You know, and he's going out in the woods and he sees this, and what does he do? He invents Velcro, right? It's called use of analogy for creative thinking, right? What else sticks? And when you're trying to make something go faster, you have models like Hertz Gold or Easy Pass on the highway. You have models in the world that you can tap into and use. And those models using analogy are great. I mean, Matt Rusk is the guy, I believe, who asked when they're trying to design a much better hypertension clinic, well, what about if we did it like Jiffy Lube? And everyone's like, Jiffy Lube? What are you talking, Jiffy Lube? But like, they're incredibly good and cheap and fast at one thing, changing your oil. What if you did a clinic that's that, right? So that's the second analogy. And then there's a third one. And I think, again, it's learnable, right? Deletion, just getting rid of stuff. So most people add when they're trying to innovate. But like, this is a picture of, an engine, and oil change is the topic here. Like, an oil change takes forever if you've ever changed the oil in a mower, tractor, lawnmower, right? And it's all these steps you see on the screen, 1 to 15, and there's a whole bunch of stuff going on there. But the essence of it is the oil, draining the oil, cleaning up the oil, having to go dispose of the oil. That's why it's an hours long, you know, process. And so if you actually asked, well, what if I just got rid of that, you know, like loose oil that can go places and get messy and get strained, you know, that's a complete rethink. It's not an incremental thinking. So that deletion approach, if you click here, you'll see what they did, right? This easy change oil cartridge from John Deere. So instead of an hour and a half, it's 30 seconds. You twist the old one, take it out, put the new one in, no loose oil, none of those steps. You've gone from 15 steps to one, right? And so getting rid of stuff, right? So Hertz got rid of the line and they solved for the absence of the line, right? I need to get paid. I need to know who to hold accountable if you crash my car. I can do all that online the night before. Deletion is a very, very powerful technique. So those would be my three. I do have a bonus one if you want the leaders one.
I would love the bonus one. I have to just chuckle. I mean, this is what makes great engineers like do cool stuff. I got one of those burrs in my hair and I just wound up with the Dorothy Hamill haircut, for goodness sake. And he's inventing Velcro.
It's noticing things. So much of it is just noticing things. I mean, Cindy can talk about, you know, even just beginning of some of her, say, motherhood, but like, Cindy, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I remember sort of the noticing that everyone was on their phones texting through the appointments was part of what happened. Like, you noticed something, right?
Yeah, it's actually kind of comical because that, at this point, like, text-based solutions are a little more kind of embedded throughout a lot of things. But back then when we were, like you said, trying to solve for the problem of how do we make getting to the office easier, right, by texting people a reminder, making a walk-in clinic, but then in the end, we just got rid of the office appointment altogether. We just got the information a different way, right? What we really wanted was the information. We didn't really need it by way of the offices, but you're right. We just noticed everyone was on their cell phone and we're like, could we like leverage that to get the information we actually needed? But I never framed it as a deletion or like getting rid of something, but it really was. We got rid of the office visit.
Beautiful.
That's really cool. Let me jump in and give us some of the audience answers to what are the characteristics of good problem solvers. And then Roy, I'm going to give you, I want to know the bonus technique. What I like is Sean Fitzpatrick just wrote Roy. So I think you are the characteristic of a good problem solver. Good listeners came up. Thanks, Jess and Carl and Noel. Intellectual curiosity. Thanks, Dave. Kelly, open to possibilities. Open to the ideas of others. Thanks, Kim. Good problem solvers don't accept the status quo. Thanks, Elizabeth. Empathy, perseverance, critical thinking, thinking outside the box, asking really good open-ended questions. Bob W., as a child, he would always ask why. Me too. My parents were convinced I was going to be a lawyer. Nope. Open-minded, asking why, comfortable questioning the norm. That's a good one, and we're going to get back to that one, Cheryl. Thanks. Able to see the big picture, yet also able to analyze the small detail. Yeah, narrow thinking, broad thinking. Thanks, Megan. Strong listeners, curiosity, checking assumptions. Listening to the people who are actually working at the source of the problem. Thanks, Cynthia. You're so right. Going right there to the front lines with the people who know the processes the best. They know often the best solutions as well. Purposely being open-minded. Thanks, Sam. Agree, open, outside thinking. Looks for input from unexpected sources. Thanks, Andy. That's a great one. Yeah, Roy, give me your last one.
The last slide? Yeah, you know, so this is targeted towards leaders. Targeted, little joke there, I guess. Uh-huh. So, you know, Matt Press and others and I kind of rediscovered this recently in that we often talk about metrics, readmission rate, length of stay, you know, infection rate, whatever, but we often don't talk about targets. You know, in the absence of a target or a small target like, hey, improve this 5%, doesn't really drive creative thinking because you aren't forced to throw out all of your assumptions and all the status quo ways of doing things. You know, so people like who are in the do your best you can, every bit helps, make it faster, like those are all fails, right? Those are all not good leadership things to say. You know, if you say, look, you know, in Zinner's world, I need you to get rid of, you know, 100% of something or 80% of something or 60% of something. Now you've got to question everything. And now you're back in that mode of being inventive, you know? And so if you said, cut 5% off length of stay, I'd be rigorous. I'd follow people through, I observe everything. I look at everything they do and I look for how to shave seconds here and minutes there. And those are all good things, right? But if you said you got to get people out 2 days faster, now I'm thinking, you know, the way people like Kristen Leitner and Healing at Home or Rebecca Trotter with Geriatric Care and SOAR, you know, and Kathleen and others, you know, just fundamentally changed it. Or as Cindy said, like, just get rid of the clinic altogether. I'm going to revisit those fundamental assumptions when I'm given more aggressive targets. So that was the bonus.
I love the bonus. And I love the punny joke around targets. Let me ask the audience, what models or approaches do you use to challenge your own thinking, to keep it fresh, and to drive innovation? In the meantime, let me turn it over to you, Sindhu. I'd love to hear one of your own stories where you thought about things and solved for something differently and got a great result. Brag to me a little.
Well, I think that I have to talk a little bit more in detail about, I guess we alluded to heart-safe motherhood. Roy brought it up and we were kind of talking about getting rid of the clinic, but it was like, you know, as physicians, just wanting to do the best for patients when they left the hospital, knowing that they had this risk of getting sicker and worse when they left. And, you know, coming up with solutions or strategies to like get their blood pressure a couple of days later, and trying to make that as patient friendly as possible by creating these walk-in clinics, texting, all these things, but we just couldn't move the mark on it, right? And so we were desperate for, why is this just not working? Like, we're trying to make it so flexible, you don't even have to tell us you're coming, just like walk right in. Like, and then as Roy sort of alluded to, we sort of were like, maybe we're just not thinking about this the right way. Like, it shouldn't be this hard to get the information that we need. But then we sort of said, well, why do we always ask patients? The model is always for patients to come to us rather than for us to sort of think differently about what do we really need? We really need blood pressures and need them on these certain days after patients go home. And so we don't really need to see every patient. We actually just need information. And so how could we do that in a different way? And so we, you know, started off with working with the Innovation Center. And I would agree that talking to people that are not subject matter experts, that actually are good problem solvers but don't know anything about what you're doing, is the best way to come up with creative solutions. You know, people probe you for questions. They're just asking very basic questions, and you as the subject matter expert have to really give them some answers, and then it sort of gets you thinking in a totally different way. And that really led us to partnering with patients, developing this text-based strategy, asking patients to like help us sort of partner with us and say, you know, can we try this out with you? Like, when you go home, here's what we want you to do, getting feedback from them. And now, you know, 6, 7 years later, we're have this program that's now, you know, kind of our standard of care for the way that we evaluate and ascertain blood pressures when people go home. And we've been able to keep women safe at home, reduce disparities related to blood pressure ascertainment and treatment. And it's gone live across Penn Medicine, and even will be sort of starting in other hospitals in Philadelphia as well. And so it's just it's exciting, but there's so many like lessons that are embedded in there. A lot of lessons that people just brought up in the chat around kind of some of the ways to be good leaders in the space.
Thanks, Sindhu, and congratulations. It sounds like a great win. Roy, let me go back.
She doesn't brag about herself enough though, because, you know, Sindhu and Adi Hirschberg and Deb Driscoll when she was there, now Liz, you know, there's a reason they have like one of the most amazing portfolios, not just projects, but, you know, portfolios of care delivery innovation, because they are constantly challenging things. They're encouraging people to ask, like, why does it have to be this way? And I just want to point one thing out to the Sindhu not taking no, or perseverance, or, you know, challenging norms, all those things that came up. And I can't remember if this was Sindhu or if it was Adi, but, you know, back then, like Sindhu said, you couldn't text, right? And so normally this question we normally ask is like, can I? Can I dot, dot, dot? You know, and an innovation or creative problem solving question is different. It's how can I? Mm-hmm. Right? I'm not going to take no for an answer. Like, no is not even part of the set there. It's just how can I? So, because if you said, can I text? The answer would have been like, no. Even, I mean, doctors were texting, but it was kind of against the rules. So, like, if you said, how can I text? You know, then Lauren Steinfeld and others, you know, again, surround yourself with lots of good partners. Like, well, look, if you consent people in a certain way and ask, you know, and get certain permissions. You know, so the how can I versus the can I is a fundamentally different question.
I love that on the chat, Dr. Rachel says, heart-safe motherhood literally revolutionized postpartum care. And that's awesome. Roy, this is not always for the faint of heart. Like, you can get it wrong and you could be under like aggressive time pressure, as Lester points out in the chat. Yeah. So, I mean, no one likes to get it wrong, especially here at Penn Medicine. So have you ever had an idea just go south, and what did you learn from it?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I've had lots of ideas go south. We could have several sessions on that alone. You know, maybe the one that stands out to me, and I'm like, which one do I talk about? I actually tried to create a brokerage, you know, like Fidelity or, you know, Vanguard, you know, things along those lines. And, you know, we had noticed in the early 90s, a couple things, like trading volume had gone through the roof. Everyone was making money on internet stocks and the stock markets were going crazy. And that the way to make the most money was get closer and closer to transactions. So if you could get to the trade, you know, and trading stocks, like that's where a lot of the money was, right? Or the asset management piece. So it made all the sense in the world. And you know, we had this kind of really creative idea. We, because of TurboTax and Quick and some other things, we actually could give you real-time, you know, insight into tax implications. If you sold this, you know, these shares, if you took this action in your investing world, here's what the tax implication of that would be. And we went off and said, well, we can do this. We have this differentiated brokerage. Massive, massive failure, right? And for a lot of reasons. And some of them are what set me on the path that we talk about here. You know, first of all, we didn't start with a big unmet need. Like, we didn't actually start with the fact, like, this is a seriously important problem for someone. It was more starting with, here's something we could do. You know, creativity without grounding in, like, so what, doesn't go very well. So that, you know, that was clearly, you know, one lesson. But, you know, the bigger lesson, you know, I guess maybe even where you started to ask the question about, you know, the kind of the environment we do it in, is like, that was, you know, what we call failure, right? When you spend a lot of time and a lot of money, and when you're wrong, it hurts, right? And so since then, that was the early 2000s, all of the methodology has evolved into, I don't even call it fail fast and fail cheap anymore, which was sort of the next way people talked about it. It was much more hypothesis driven, like, what must be true? Like, what are your big assumptions? And everything, you know, we teach here in the center, and, you know, Cindy's amazing at this, as is her whole team, it's sort of like, okay, here's what I believe must be true, that they'll do this, that they'll have this, that they'll think this, that they'll push that button. And then you design all these little experiments. So if a little experiment doesn't work, you didn't fail, you just basically invalidated a hypothesis, right? So we're away from this notion, so you can do it safely, you can do it quickly, you can do it cheaply, right? And in this environment, you can actually keep doing it again and again until you've, you know, figure out a good path. So, you know, you don't want failures like I had in the early 2000s. That was too big. We can't afford those kind of failures. But that doesn't mean don't take risks and don't worry about being wrong. That's all great. Like, that's totally fine. But you got to do it in a way that you test things quickly in an experimental method. That's really what I learned.
Thanks. I think that's really great. I also have adopted some self-talk. So when we try stuff out and it doesn't go real well, I'm always saying to myself, congratulations, I'm sorry, and get back out there. Because it's both. Okay, I learned something. That's good. And I'm sorry, because usually you have a little skin in the game and it hurts a little when it doesn't work right the first time. And yet you get back out there. Sindhu, talk to me. How have you ever had something not go right? And then how did you coach yourself to get back out there and try something else?
Yeah, one of the examples I can remember, I think of when I think about something that didn't go well is, or didn't go right, which again, as Roy said, I think reframed sort of thinking about it as not really a failure. It's more of a, you get better by trying things and being open with no ego to the fact that it might not work. And in fact, going in with the assumption that it, the first time is probably not going to be the best or won't work the best is, I think, the right way to approach a lot of trials of these things. But we, this was probably like 10 or 12 years ago, we took on this trying to revolutionize the way that we admit patients to labor and delivery, because we got a lot of patient complaints that they, you know, the residents asking us all these questions at admission, the nurses ask us the same questions, they're happening separately. We are also patients here. Don't you already know this information? Isn't it in our chart? It's like a lot of redundancy, and the patients were getting frustrated. And we also found that, like, there was some delays in certain things because everybody was doing this sort of parallel process. So we said, okay, well, let's do everything together. Let's have a group admission with the nurse and the resident and everybody all together. And we sort of, for a little while, like, just sort of said, okay, this is how it's going to happen. And, you know, all those stakeholder groups, like, sort of developed the process. But in retrospect, I don't know that we really, A, were solving for the right problem, or B, actually really got into the real and very clear independent and different workflows between nurses and physicians that really couldn't just be joined together, and that there's, like, negative consequences to just sort of assuming that that could be the solution. But we were just solving for trying to lower redundancy for the patient, which I don't know that that was the right problem to be solving for. So we tried it and we tracked it, and it just wasn't going well. So we kept being cheerleaders, like, come on, guys, like, let's try to do this together, you know, and then it kind of fell apart. And then when you sort of step away from that and say, well, that's okay, like, we tried that, that wasn't a good solution. And now we've come up several years later with a much better solution that kind of really hits at the right problems, which is really around safety and quality of the admission and reducing delays. and also accomplishes incorporating the patient into that process. So our solution now is much better, but went through a much more iterative process and actually was one of the PIIA projects back several years ago by a couple of, of our residents and some of our nursing and attending colleagues. So I think it just a lot of learning, some of the similar learning to what sort of Roy brought up around wasn't solving for the right problem. It was a forced solution. But I think if you can put aside your ego, because when you start, I think leaders have trouble sometimes feeling they feel like they need to like have the solution and that that solution has to work. But sometimes it's just not the right solution. And that's actually okay because you often learn a lot from that process and these quick pilots or trials. And framing everything is, let's just try this. Let's try it. Let's look again in a couple of weeks and we'll sort of see how it goes. If it doesn't work, we'll kind of get everybody's feedback and tweak it. And I think that sort of actually creates a culture of people not being afraid to try things.
Thanks. I love that. And I think for those who are going to go to the book club, you probably have read Think Again. If you're not, like, you've got time. This book really talks about rethinking to the point that Sindhu is making. Sindhu, let me stick with you. Change can often be uncomfortable. Sometimes trying new things can be met with a bit of resistance. As a leader, how have you successfully overcome resistance to changing things up?
I think it's a great question. I think people are very comfortable in the way that things are. And so change can be really hard. I think there's a couple of things I'll sort of point to. One is often when there's a problem that grounds us all or something that everyone wants to fix, using that and using the data around that to sort of create an environment where people are all in the change mindset because everybody wants to change that. So I think data and sharing that with people is really important. I think what I said before about the fact that no change is permanent. Change is transient, right? So if we want to try to fix something, let's try something. Let's get everybody's input into that. So stakeholder input is super important in the process. Enough notice for people to know that this change is happening. But the idea that it's not like we're fixing it and we're never going to look at it again, I think is really critical for people. Because when you tell people that we got your feedback, we're going to do it for 2 weeks, but we'll talk to you again and you can give us some more feedback. I think that really takes down a lot of the discomfort that people have because they know they'll have an opportunity to give feedback again.
Yeah.
Thanks. I really love Let me go to the audience. I'd love to pose the same question. If you've gotten resistance when you're trying something new, what are the things and the strategies you use from a change management perspective to really decrease resistance? Roy, I'd love to hear your point too.
Yeah, no, thanks. I just want to jump in. I totally agree with Cinder and just wanted to kind of build on some of the things she said. Yeah, so first of all, I mean, some resistance can be good, right? You know, because people are resisting often for reasons of experience or expertise. You know, it's like, I'm worried about this, I'm worried about that. And so it's reverse engineering those to what they're worried about so you can see whether you can solve for it or not. You know, in fact, the question, what are you worried about? Like if someone comes out and says, no, it's too risky, like I can't do anything with that. But if you then respond, well, hey, tell me what you're worried about. And they say, oh, I'm worried about, you know, patient data and, you know, getting to this party that shouldn't have it. I'm like, oh, that is something I can actually solve for. So I think in this new world, like the most effective leaders, the highest performance leaders on the highest performance teams have sort of evolved away from this sort of thumbs up, thumbs down. This thing is blessed and this thing is forbidden. And they've kind of gotten more to the, hey, you know what? I see what you're trying to do. Here's what must be true. You have to address this and you have to prove that to me. And they identify sort of the key assumptions that need to be tested with these experiments that we talk about. Right. And so they're more identifying the things that must be true as you go up and run your experiment and come back to me with evidence. Because frankly, as a leader, like I'm not going to be convinced by your PowerPoint or by your persuasive speech. I'm going to ask you to run an experiment and come back to me with some data and some evidence. And if you can get into that conversation with a leader who is appropriately resistant, like there's good things about risk adversity, you know, then you can start to say, look, I did it with 5 patients, you know, in the last 2 days, and actually, here's what happened. And just quickly, it reminds me of the story. One of the bigger businesses we built back in the day was actually a payments business, you know, and people are aware of things like PayPal and Square and companies like that nowadays. But that was one of those really rich areas to experiment with, and we had an idea to do it. And the leadership said, no, you really can't go forward. There's the risk of fraud is so high, we don't want to deal with all the fraud that's going to happen. And, you know, there's a difference of opinion about, you know, whether this fraud is going to happen or not. And I remember sort of asking, well, you know, would you be okay with like losing $2,000, $5,000? Like, how much fraud, you know, are you comfortable with? And they're like, yeah, I mean, $5,000, that's fine. I'm worried about millions. I'm like, so we set up a pool of $5,000 and said, I'm going to run this to see how much fraud there is. And if we ever hit $5,000 of losses, I'm going to stop. Right. And it was like this backstop. And so it allowed this kind of, again, experiment to show that they might be right and I might be wrong and I might be right and they might be wrong. But it's like, it's this ability to say, well, like, what's real? What's actually going to happen? And can you design for this problem? So that's, you know, one quick story in that case of converting people through evidence.
Thanks. A couple of things in the chat came on in terms of how our leaders are dealing with some resistance. Holding on to your hypothesis loosely and with a curious eye, preparing people for what is and is not changing, telling a story about change in a way that's impactful for your stakeholders, leaning on early adopters, engaging resistors in discussions. Dr. Rosen says, communicate, communicate, communicate. This is the why of the change. This is the how. And here are the check-ins as to what's working and what's not. I think saying, let's just try it and see how it goes and indicate that you want feedback early and often on how things are going. Thanks, Kim. Active listening. Asking questions about the resistance to better understand it. Great comments in the chat. Thank you. I appreciate those. Yeah, really good.
Yeah. I'll throw one last one out there, you know, which is sometimes it really helps to have someone see something with their own eyes. You know, they don't get it or they don't care about it until they experience it. You know, when I started, the very first thing I think I said before the slides was, you know, this embedded research, this ethnography or contextual inquiry. But like, you know, it's not just insight, it's also empathy, right? You know, and if you get to know the people who are struggling with a problem, that could be your care team, you know, nurses or doctors on the floor, it could be the patients or their families. Like when you experience it, it takes on a whole new resonance. And so sometimes having them see it themselves instead of filtered through you is good. And the next best thing is storytelling. And we can, you know, storytelling is so persuasive.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that. That Gemba walk, as they say in Lean Six Sigma, verbiage can be really helpful of really seeing the problem with your own two eyes. Let me go to Sindhu. Sindhu, when you're hiring someone, how can you assess these abilities in a person? Their ability to think creatively, be strong problems, question everything. Are there questions you ask? Is there a vibe you're looking for? How do you make that assessment?
I often pose them with a problem that we're having and say, like, this is like an issue we're having where we have too many, you know, we don't have enough beds. We're over capacity. So everything's backed up on our unit. You know, when we don't discharge our postpartum patients, our labor and delivery gets backed up, and then our triage gets backed up. And there are certain things that become medically acute that you have to figure out how to deal with. And how would you go about thinking about that in the moment? I might pose sort of a problem, and it's not to sort of assess whether they come to a solution that I like or not. It's actually the contrary, right? It's actually to sort of think, like, watch, like, how do they think about this problem? Like, who are they going to talk to about it? How are they going to understand the problem? How are they going to approach it sort of both in the moment or even sort of for like a longer term kind of solution? I feel like giving people real problems or real things that we're struggling with sort of and seeing how they walk or think through it is really important. And I think in my mind, one of the more effective strategies to just see how people think and what they
like. I like that too, because I'll just say my inherent bias is that I like everyone who interviews with us. And yet when I can ask a specific, like, can you please tell me an example of a time where you had to solve something that was really hard and you solved it differently, when they talk about the work, then I'm able to say, do they have the competency needed to be successful both here at Penn Medicine and in solving the types of problems that we at PMA solve? So if you're looking for interview techniques, we have a lot of resources on the PMA talent development site under interviewing, because there are a couple of competencies that goes to some of this, whether it's courage, creative problem solving, perspective, learning agility. There's quite a few questions that you can use. So Sindhu, thanks. And I'd love to hear any questions that you in the chat use as well to identify this. Roy, one of the hallmarks of the Innovation Center is they're really creative problem solvers, and you and David and the team have created a really cool culture. How have you coached your team to be better problem solvers? Advice you can give me and our leaders watching today on how to get our teams even better at this?
Yeah, I mean, I am blessed with the team that we have and with the clinical partners we've gotten to work with. You know, so much of it is things that we have talked about, Cindy, right? You know, we talk about getting embedded, going seeing reality for what it is first. We definitely talk about who can you bring in. You know, we're not the experts in everything, you know, and who you can learn from is a big part of it. So much storytelling, right? I mean, the way analogies spread is everyone's talking about stories that they might have. I mean, I was telling a story the other day on deletion techniques, and I don't know if you guys know what this is. This is the zip top, you know. Yeah. And I was telling this story about how I cannot stand how often I lose my Tupperware lids. You know, and my first thing was finding, you know, Tupperware that had the lids attached. And, you know, but then I realized that's not good for the dishwasher because they take up too much space with these attached lids. You can't wash them. And then, you know, using the analogy thinking, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, like, what about like Ziploc bags? They just the top zips, like, you know. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna invent this, it'd be great. And then of course I go online and find that somebody's already invented it, you know. So practicing these analogies, these deletion techniques, telling stories about it, you know, is how it spreads as a culture. Having the people you know, tell the stories of what they've done, you know, to the rest of the team. We try to make sure that cross fertilization is going on as much as possible. And those are sort of the ways we do it. We do bring in outside speakers. I mean, I think being aware of what's going on in the world outside of healthcare is critical. You know, listening to the best startup stories, the best entrepreneurs, the best investors, you know, the best writers, books, et cetera, all these things happening out there. There's just so much happening. It starts with noticing that maybe something you're hearing about is relevant.
Thanks. Christina said that she listened to the NPR podcast this morning called Transforming the Toilet. Really interesting to see how people are questioning how to change sanitation. And it was really fascinating. So your point, you can be learning and being aware of this everywhere. Cindy, let me change gears a bit. People are dying to hear about your career. Can you give me a nugget of wisdom that helped you on your journey to become the leader that you've become?
Yeah, I think I'm thinking for a minute, mostly because I think I'm so grateful to the people that I've gotten to work with. I feel like I've learned a lot along the way from all of the people that I've worked with. But I think my general feeling is that I think good leaders are sort of tasked with facilitating and inspiring people, right? So it's not all about having the solutions yourself. It's about creating a culture of people in your team that all feel comfortable trying things, pushing the envelope, especially with the goal of really like wanting to make things better. And I think that for me, that sort of mission of we're just trying to all do better and we're trying to do it together. And how do I, and no thing that goes awry, no trial that goes awry is a reflection on me as an individual. And I think that's where leaders sometimes sort of get lost a little bit because they feel the weight of sort of those non-successes as sort of their failure. And as Roy said, I actually don't even like to use that word because I think all of this is about trying and getting better. And every time you try, even if it's not what you thought you were going to end up with, there's something that was learned from that experience. And so I think the approach of just being inclusive and collaborative and honestly, actually asking people who don't have the subject matter expertise, like I find some of the most interesting and informative conversations about potential solutions being with people that don't do what you do, right? That are just like informal conversations. We're like, hey, like this is what I'm thinking about doing. Like, what do you think about that? And so it just gets your mind open. And so I really, I think that in doing all of those things and having an approach that's been collaborative and inclusive and multidisciplinary, I think is what's with a great team. I really like couldn't have asked for all the teams I've worked with here, especially at Penn Medicine and who I work with now are just amazing people. So I think it's the success is a joint success.
Thanks, Sindhu. Roy, people are dying to know why you made the change from Silicon Valley to healthcare. So can you give us a little bit of that story in like 1 minute or less, as well as maybe your own nugget of wisdom on how you became who you are?
Well, the nugget on why I'm here is, you know, I married a woman from Philly. I was still living in Silicon Valley. And, you know, I wanted to keep her happy. So her family was in Belican, and I wasn't going to do anything to get her angry. So that's what brought me to Philly. And then flying cross country for a bunch of years, you know, starts wearing me. But, you know, I did, honestly, it was not just passive. I went looking for a social mission. I went looking to ask questions about how do you make a difference. And in fact, we had been doing behavior change work similar to what, you know, Kevin Volpe and David Esch and others do here. And we were able to show that we could make $60 million, $80 million, $100 million by these behavior change interventions. And of course, when you see that, you start to wonder, well, gee, I wonder if I can do this for good instead of for profit. And actually, I didn't know all of that was going on at Penn, even though I was living in Philadelphia. So I took walks with a bunch of Penn physicians and friends, and Kevin Volpe was one of the first. And once I saw what was going on at Penn, I was like, wow, I mean, I don't know anything about healthcare, but I wonder if I could take any of this stuff that we learned of deploying that at scale and doing it here. So it's been fun. You know, my journey, I guess the quickest nugget might be maybe a back-to-back fail versus success story or something I learned and then applied. You know, in the early days of Quicken, I remember one of my first jobs was to go after the thing that was the most annoying to our customers, which is data entry. It reminds me a little bit of the documentation burden that a lot of our physicians deal with. Like typing things in was the problem everyone hated. And they sent me off on a task. You know, I had to go research what were all of these problems. And we learned about data entry shortcuts, right? And data entry shortcuts were cool. You could start typing in, you know, BL, and it would fill in Bloomingdale's, you know, and clothing, whatever. Like, so you start and it finishes, it does work for you. So we had all these shortcuts. You type T in today's, and it turns into today's date in a date field. And so I did thousands of hours of research on all the work people hated, and came up with, it ranked all this and did all this hard work and came up with the top shortcuts. If we implement these shortcuts, we'll make the most people the happiest. And I remember one of the people on my team saying, "You're a knucklehead." And I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "What do you think all these shortcuts and all this anger about data entry is really telling you?" You know, and eventually I realized the point was they didn't like data entry. And, you know, their idea, not my idea, was to get rid of all the data entry, right? It was like a deletion thing. It was to just download it from the banks and brokerages, just take it from its existing source. Why make people force them to retype it all in? And I took that with me because I remember I remember asking the wrong question or thinking about it in what seemed like the wrong way. And then years later, when the internet came about, or the consumer internet, and, you know, it was all, there were two things driving the early internet. You know, pornography was one, and we were a finance company, so we weren't doing pornography. And the other one was investing, right? And it was stock quotes, everyone getting stock quotes. And you could get a stock quote anywhere. You know, find a quote on any stock you're interested in. And I was driving tons of volume, but they were all just me too sites. They were all, you know, one's as good as another. And I remembered, this was the first time I can remember leading an innovation, thinking, gee, how can I go from just being yet another place where people get stock quotes to the gold was, if they set up their portfolio, here's a set of stocks, here are the 8, 10 stocks they're following. If I could just get them to do it with me instead of someone else. And what we did, you know, was basically, now it would be called sort of the combination of friction removal and loss aversion. But I use the analogy of, if you remember Microsoft Word's the last files used, if you go up to file, there's this like, here's the last files used. Like you open files and it remembers the last things you did. So we got rid of the upfront registration, upfront logging in, and just as they got quotes, we just remembered what quote they were getting and added them. And like, here's all the quotes, and we just built their portfolio. And instead of registering upfront, we moved everything to the back. Like, if you don't want to lose it, you can now register so it doesn't go away. Instead, we have to do all this work up front. And we went from, you know, like the last place site, we almost caught, we ended up right behind Yahoo at the time, who was the top rated site. And so using that to actually drive our creative problem solving has got me addicted. And I've been addicted ever since.
I love it. Well, we're lucky to have you as our addict here at Penn Medicine. Sindhu, in 30 seconds or less, what's one thing maybe people don't know about you?
I am a classical Indian dancer.
Ooh, cool.
I do. It's a very ancient form of Indian dance called Bharatanatyam. And I studied it from when I was a young kid. I actually graduated. So the graduation was a 2-hour live independent solo performance with hundreds and hundreds of people there. And that was when I was in high school. And then after that, I actually did it professionally for a little while, even when I was a resident for the first couple of years. And then I couldn't keep up with the practicing and everything, but I'm going to get back to it.
That's cool. I may need a picture of this or a video.
There's got to be YouTube for this.
I think our audience needs to see this. Roy, what about you? Same questions, maybe in 1 minute or less, because we're running tight. What's something maybe people don't know about you?
I probably eat more chocolate than anyone you've ever met in your life.
I don't know. You just had strawberries. I don't know. Is that true?
I probably have 2 to 3 chocolate bars a day. So I hope my doctor's not listening right now.
What's your go-to?
Is it dark chocolate?
Dark chocolate. Yes, I'm addicted to dark chocolate. Professionally, one thing that a lot of people don't know about me is that before there was Moneyball, where they showed sort of people the power of big data in sports and how it's been used throughout professional sports, I actually did the foundational work showing that you could predict things that nobody believed you could predict. And I decided that I could beat the old men in the back room who were setting the lines, the spreads, and gambling. And so I built my own databases, and I built a predictive model that showed that I could place bets that beat the spread, and I ended up winning against the spread 81% of the time, and got convinced that there was actually power or value to be extracted from large data sets.
Really cool. Thanks. Wow. And I love Moneyball. If you haven't seen Moneyball, add it to your list. Great. Roy, Sindhu, I can't thank you enough for being our guest today. Not only are you amazing leaders, but you're both great teachers, and I love being your colleague. So thank you so much for taking the risk and coming on Lunch with Leaders, and it's been a real pleasure. So July is a scorcher, everyone, and we've got 2 more hot shows in July. You want to make sure you're adding them to your calendar. Do not miss July 15th. We're going to talk redefining high potentials. Dr. Mitch Schnall, our chair of radiology, Chris Tierney, our CHRO from Pennsylvania Hospital, and one of our favorites, go-to expert, Michelle Weitzman-Garcia, will be here to really talk about how do we manage high potentials now. Our last show in July, who does not want to be a stronger communicator? We've talked so much today, even about how to use storytelling and good communication tips to manage change. Don't miss Debbie Foster from Corporate Communications, Sarah Johnson from Penn Medicine at Home, and Dr. Sean Grady, the physician lead of the Neurosciences Service Line, on July 29th. 2 more hot shows in July. I really hope we'll see you here. I want to thank each of you for joining us today. I want to thank you all for your service. Thank you all for showing up, learning, rethinking, thinking differently, and stepping up into your leadership role each and every day. I hope you get a little downtime this weekend, and we're so grateful for you. I look forward to